get started. We're looking at Numbers 27 to 30. And if Numbers 18 and 19 was not your favorite section of Numbers, then this certainly will be. And so we're looking at laws, as you can see here, about the Promised Land, the offerings that they're going to be making when they get there, and then some things dealing with vows. And I think we'll probably spend two more classes on the book of Numbers. I think we next time we can do 31 to 33 or so, or 34, and then, I think it'll be two more classes that and we'll be done. So one of the things that I had sent out in the email yesterday is that if you have any recommendations or suggestions on what you'd like to study after Numbers, I'm willing to hear that. We've talked about Leviticus. Somebody had texted me saying that they would like to do Romans. And so I think some other people have said a couple other things. So if anybody does have some kind of preference, just let me know on what that is. And then we'll work with whatever the recommendations or suggestions are for that. So this morning, let's get started with looking at the outline chart that we have been looking at throughout this series on Numbers. The first 10 chapters, the Israelites are at Mount Sinai. And remember that they got to Mount Sinai back in Exodus chapter 19, around 50 days or so after they were delivered from Egypt, which was kind of in a sense like the first Pentecost, 50 days after deliverance. That's when they receive the law. And so they're there for a few years, and then they set out to go to the Promised Land. So chapters 11 through 21 of Numbers should be the book of Joshua. They get to the Promised Land, they take the Promised Land, but instead, what is the big reason why they don't enter the Promised Land in that section of Numbers? They're afraid. Cowardice, you know, the idea of unbelief, that they didn't trust God to be able to take out the giants in the land. It reminds me of Revelation 22 when it talks about that list of people that won't enter into the new heavens and the new earth, and one of them saying people who are cowardly. That's the same problem that they had here. You guys remember in chapters 11 through 21, how many complaints do the Israelites make in these chapters? If somebody said it, I didn't hear it. Seven. It's seven complaints. And we had that chart before that shows how there's a parallel structure to the complaints. They begin and end with them complaining about food or sustenance. And then God does something to do with fire, where he sends fire around the camp. The last one, he sends the fiery serpents. And then the second one, and the second to the last one, is when Moses fails to intercede for them. The third, and the third to the last, is complaining about leadership, with Miriam and Aaron teaming up against Moses, and then you've got Korah's rebellion. But then the middle complaint deals with this idea of cowardice, that we can't enter the land. They're grumbling about the situation that they're in, and so that's why they're sentenced to 40 years in the wilderness. But beginning in chapters 22 through 26, the Israelites are on the cusp of the Promised Land, and they're setting up for re-entry. And before they enter in the book of Joshua, Moses is still going to have a series of about three speeches in the book of Deuteronomy. And so we're in this section in Numbers where we're looking at some extra laws that are going to help them know how to handle themselves in the Promised Land, a lot of which has some parallel to the first 10 chapters, but we're also getting new information as we go through this. Any comments or questions on that before we say a little bit more to introduce what we're looking at this morning? All right. Well, before we get started then, Ben, could I ask you to pray for us? Okay. A couple of things to say about these chapters specifically is that these instructions, like other chapters we've seen in Numbers, assume and promise that they will enter the land. We've seen some of that in chapter 15, right after they're told that they're going to be sentenced to the wilderness for 40 years, and even after they try to take the land and they fail. In chapter 15, it says, when you enter the land, here's some supplemental things to add to your animal sacrifices. Chapter 18, it talks about the provisions for the priests. The only way that you can give those things to the priests is if you're in a land that's flowing with milk and honey that allows you to give those things to such people. And so in these chapters, embedded in these instructions and these laws are promises that they will enter the land. And we're also seeing in this that it's in the context of things that are new. We saw in chapter 26 that there's a new generation with the new census. We're going to see in chapter 27 that there's going to be a new leader, Joshua. In chapters 28 and 29, there's going to be some new instructions for worship. And so God is getting ready this new generation to go and enter. So the outline of what we're looking at this morning, 27, 1 through 11, is going to be the daughters of Zelophehad or Zelophehad, whatever you want to say. Then you've got the succession of Joshua. Chapters 28 and 29 is the offerings for the feasts. And I'll have some charts on that, but we're not going to read all of it. And then chapter 30 is going to be some laws regarding vows when they would, I guess, enter the land. So let's go ahead and start out with the situation with the daughters of Zelophehad. I'm going to keep saying it different ways as we go through this. But let's go ahead and look at Numbers 27, starting with verses 1 through 4. Then drew near the daughters of Zelophehad, the son of Hepher, son of Gilead, son of Machir, son of Manasseh, from the clans of Manasseh, the son of Joseph. The names of his daughters were Mahlah, Noah, Hoglah, Milcah, and Tirzah. And they stood before Moses and before Eleazar the priest and before the chiefs and all the congregation at the entrance of the tent of meeting, saying, our fathers died in the wilderness. He was not among the company of those who gathered themselves together against the Lord in the company of Korah, but died for his own sin, and he had no sons. Why should the name of our father be taken away from his clan because he had no son? Give to us a possession among our father's brothers. All right. So we've got this. This is a semi-famous section of the book of Numbers. Numbers 36 talks again about these same people. But how many daughters does this guy Zelophehad or Zelophehad have? He's got five daughters, no sons. And so they all come before Moses and Eleazar and they talk about their father's death. Now, what do they say about their father's death? It's not because of Korah's rebellion back in Numbers 16. Why would that be important to bring that up? He wasn't involved in one of these gross immoralities that happened in the nation. Like, you know, even though like the rest of the nation, they had unbelief. This guy kind of was in that category of having the general unbelief that caused the whole nation to not enter. But he wasn't one of those guys involved in Korah's rebellion. I think when it says he died for his own sin, I think that's talking perhaps about this general unbelief that the nation had. But he wasn't involved in some of those things, is kind of the idea. And so he left no sons. The sons are the ones who received the inheritance. And so the question here is, how is the land going to stay in this family? Because if it passes from the father to the son, but this guy had no sons, what's going to happen to these daughters? And so because of these circumstances, what impresses you about these daughters and what they're asking for in verse 4? Yeah. Yeah, like, you see how strong their request is? They're pretty bold in how they ask for this. What else is noteworthy or impressive to you about their request? Yeah, they're concerned with the family name, with the father's name being perpetuated. What else? Yeah, Janice? Yeah, good. They're trusting that somehow God can do something about these circumstances, even though it would go against the cultural norms. What else? What is implied that they believe will happen? That they will possess the land. Like, this request comes from the presupposition that it's true that God will bring them into the promised land, he will deliver them, and he'll bring them all the promises that he said he would. And I think one lesson to learn from this is if you want the blessings of the promised land, you've got to seek for them and you've got to be asking for them. You can't be passive about it and still get it. And so that's the request that they make. Anything else you guys want to say up to verse 4 here? Sewell? No, okay. All right, let's look at verses 5 through 7 and see what the answer is. They were seeking justice. Yeah, that their name wouldn't be forgotten. You can understand how laws that say that it only goes to the son would kind of be unfair in this circumstance. Like, what would happen to the... And so the request makes a lot of sense. But what is this misogynistic, sexist God of the Old Testament going to do about the situation? Look at verses 5 through 7. Moses brought their case before the Lord, and the Lord said to Moses, "The daughters of Zelophehad are right. You shall give them possession of an inheritance among their father's brothers and transfer the inheritance of their father to them." I like that in this story here, Moses brings the case before the Lord. He doesn't presume to know the answer to everything that's happening here, even though he would be the answer man for the Israelites. Good leaders are willing to show when they're ignorant about something. But what does God say about this request? What does he say about the daughters? They're right. That what they're bringing before Moses makes sense, so he's upholding their dignity. We're going to see at the end of the book in Numbers 36 that they have to marry within their tribe of their father. And that's just going to be one of the stipulations that they're going to have to choose from that kind of pool of people that they could choose from. And so what we're seeing here in this section, look at verses 8 through 11, and we'll, if there's anything else from 5 through 7 you guys want to bring up, we can do that. But look at verses 8 through 11. "And you shall speak to the people of Israel, saying, if a man dies and has no son, then you shall transfer his inheritance to his daughter. And if he has no daughter, then you shall give his inheritance to his brothers. And if he has no brothers, then you shall give his inheritance to his father's brothers. And if his father has no brothers, then you shall give his inheritance to the nearest kinsman of his clan, and he shall possess it. And it shall be for the people of Israel a statute and a rule, as the Lord commanded Moses." All right, so what... this is something that you see several times in the law sections or the law books of the Old Testament, is that if a new situation arises for which there is no law, God will take that circumstance and listen to people requesting an answer, and they'll come up with a new precedent or a new law. You see that happening in Numbers 9. You see it happening in Numbers 15 about the guy that picked up sticks on the Sabbath day. You see it in Leviticus 24 with this son who blasphemed the name of the Lord. And so you've got different times in the Bible where things like this happen. In this particular case, you get this law about if the husband dies or the father dies without sons, then it goes to the nearest kind of thing. So, all right, anything else you guys want to say about the situation with these daughters? Yeah, Janice? That's right. Good. The book of Ruth would illustrate some of this as well. Good. Anything else? All right, so ironically, in 1 through 11 here, we're going to see that these women are going to inherit some of the promised land. But in the next section, we're going to see Moses being reminded he will not inherit any of the promised land. So there's some ironic kind of things happening in this situation here. But look at this succession that happens with Joshua. And we'll go ahead and just read the whole text. Look at verses 12 through 23. "The Lord said to Moses, go up into this mountain of Abarim and see the land that I have given to the people of Israel. When you have seen it, you also shall be gathered to your people as your brother Aaron was, because you rebelled against my word in the wilderness of Zin when the congregation quarreled, failing to uphold me as holy at the waters before their eyes. These are the waters of Meribah of Kadesh in the wilderness of Zin. Moses spoke to the Lord, saying, let the Lord, the God of the spirits of all flesh, appoint a man over the congregation, who shall go out before them and come in before them, who shall lead them out and bring them in, that the congregation of the Lord may not be as sheep that have no shepherd. So the Lord said to Moses, take Joshua the son of Nun, a man in whom is the Spirit, and lay your hand on him. Make him stand before Eleazar the priest and all the congregation, and you shall commission him in their sight. You shall invest him with some of your authority, that all the congregation of the people of Israel may obey. And he shall stand before Eleazar the priest, who shall inquire for him by the judgment of the Urim before the Lord. At his word they shall go out, and at his word they shall come in, both he and all the people of Israel with him, the whole congregation. And Moses did as the Lord commanded him. He took Joshua and made him stand before Eleazar the priest and the whole congregation, and he laid his hands on him and commissioned him as the Lord directed him through Moses. All right. Okay, so there's a lot of things to say about this reading here. First of all, God reminds Moses of his infraction. He's told to go to Mount Abarim and see the land that he's not going to enter. Now, notice how it says it in verse 12, to see the land that God has what? I have given them. Has he given it to them yet? Yes and no. At least Moses conquered the east side of the Jordan territory that 2.5 of the tribes are going to be in. But it's sure to happen. And so he's saying it like it's a past tense sort of thing. I have one question about this, though. In Deuteronomy 34, what's the mountain that Moses dies at? Mount Nebo. So why does this say that it's Mount Abarim, the mountain of Abarim? Abarim or whatever. So maybe it is a different mountain. Maybe in Deuteronomy 34, God ends up, they end up traveling somewhere else, and this makes sense to go to this mountain. Any other ideas? Maybe different people call it different things. From what I understand, it's called the mountain range of Abarim, and Mount Nebo is one of the mountains in that mountain range. That's how I understand that. That's what I read, at least. Yeah, and Pisgah, and so you've got a couple different mountains. It's like when I was in San Diego, we lived in walking distance to five mountains that you could climb up. And there are some people that would do all five of them in one day. And it was like kind of a mountain range, and you could refer to any one of them, and you'd be referring to that same kind of range area. People would know where you're talking about. So I wonder if it's something like that. All right. But one thing to point out that we talked about in Numbers 20 is that with Moses, his sin kept him from the promised land. Our sin would keep us from the promised land. And one of the themes that we've talked about, I was actually going to preach on this on Sunday until my family started throwing up. But after Moses is told he won't enter the promised land, and I'm still going to preach this lesson at some point, but you'll just get a little bit of a preview of it. After Moses is told he won't enter the promised land, where are the times in Numbers where it specifically says that Moses did as the Lord commanded him? In other words, after all of his earthly hopes were dashed, was his resolve to still serve God. And one of the times that you see that, there's going to be four main instances where Moses does exactly what the Lord says, and you see it explicitly stated. One of them is going to be in verse 22, in appointing his successor. And so I think one of the things about Moses' life, towards the end of his life, that I think is an undervalued lesson, is it's kind of like what happens in the book of Job. All of your earthly hopes have been dashed, but are you still going to resolve to serve God? Moses' hopes of going into the promised land have been dashed, but look at the things he's still doing to serve God. One of them being this very hard instruction, perhaps, of appointing your successor. But maybe it's not so hard, because look at what Moses' request is. He's the one who comes to God after he was just reminded in verses 12 through 14, you're not entering the land. And then he says, okay, God, but I want a new leader for the people, one who, and he describes this leader in a couple different ways. He says, one who will go out and come in. I think the idea of that is going out and coming in from battle. You have that imagery in Joshua 14:11, that a good leader is going to go out to battle, and he's going to come back to the people, and he's going to go out to battle again. And we see Joshua doing that in the book of Joshua. And then the other description of this leader that he wants them to have is one who will lead them and bring them in. Bring them into the land that, guess who, can't enter. Moses can't enter it. He's wanting them to have a shepherd. And so, any thoughts that you guys have on how selfless of a request this is for Moses? That you can't enter, and then Moses is saying, I want these people to still go. I want them to have a good leader. He loves the very people that constantly would be frustrating to him throughout the whole book. Any thoughts or reflections on that? Yeah, Janice? That's right. Right. Okay, good. Good. Yeah, Joan? Yes. Yeah, God knew who he was choosing. Moses is 40 years in Midian when he was literally a shepherd of sheep, probably helped train him to some degree to deal with the people that he was going to be dealing with here. But God chose the right person for the job. And you see his humility coming out here in very encouraging ways. Were you going to say something? Yeah. Yeah, if you don't have a good leader for these people, like, is it going to go well for them? Like, it's already gone bad for them even with a good leader. So, yeah, Sewell? Right. Right. Yeah, there's no voting here. It's just God. They're trusting that God is going to pick the right person. Right. Very good. Sue, were you going to say something? Where is Moses' family and children and wife? I don't know. I wish I knew the answer to that. Does anybody know? Not that I'm aware of. I don't know that they're mentioned again. Yes. Yeah. I'm not sure. Maybe we need to keep studying Deuteronomy after this to find out. I don't know. All right. Any other thoughts about the request that Moses is making? Okay. So then you actually see the succession of Joshua. God instructs Moses to do a couple of things. Now, there's a couple of things here that I think are particularly interesting about this succession that's supposed to happen. Like, look, for example, what verse was it that said that he would have some, in verse 20, that Joshua was going to have some of Moses' authority. What do you guys make of that some of Moses' authority? And by the way, verse 21 backs that up, because how does Joshua consult the Lord? Joshua is going to consult the Lord by using the Urim. It doesn't mention the Thummim, but those kind of go together a lot of the times. How did Moses communicate with God? Directly. All right, so what do you make of this business of Joshua having some of Moses' authority? He doesn't have the direct communication that Moses had. Anybody, does this remind you a little bit of anything Moses says in Deuteronomy? It's kind of cool. There's going to be a prophet that would come and be like Moses. Are we already learning, and that's Deuteronomy 18:18, are we already learning in the succession of Joshua that Joshua is not going to be like Moses? He's not the guy that you might be waiting for. We're still waiting for somebody better. Nobody has this kind of connection to the Lord, and to God, until Jesus comes. So it's like Moses is held up in this very great kind of way, and anybody that's going to lead after him is not going to have that same kind of connection. So I think in order for the Deuteronomy 18:18 prophecy to come true, that you need to have the next leader not have the same degree of authority that Moses had. So I think that's a cool little thing to connect in that. And so then we see in verses 21 to 23 that Joshua is actually commissioned. All right, so one lesson that I was going to make in my sermon from this is that Moses is showing concern for the future generation when he himself doesn't have much of a future in this life anymore. Can you guys think of any ways that we, like Moses, like maybe your earthly hopes have been dashed and whatever, what are some ways that we can still help the next generation? Okay, good. Prayer. What else? Teaching. Being an example. Yeah, like what does Moses say about Joshua to the people? What else? What about how we reach out to new converts? You know, like I think maybe obvious applications would be like I'm teaching my children the scriptures, I'm teaching them to love God, I'm caring about the next generation even if I don't have everything I wanted in this life or whatever. I'm really concerned about their well-being, but also being concerned with new Christians because as infants in Christ, are we reaching out to them and helping them grow and flourish? Are we bringing them along to some of the things that we're doing throughout the week to show them what it looks like to serve and things like that? So maybe those would just be some thought exercises that you could do later as well. All right. Anything else about the succession of Joshua? Okay. Let's then survey chapters 28 and 29. And what you're going to see in these chapters are a bunch of offerings for the different times of the year. Let me just show you, first of all, how these offerings are structured. First of all, you have offerings associated with creation. So in chapter 28, you're going to have the offerings that are the daily offerings. So every day the sun rises, that's a creation sort of thing. Every week, you have Sabbath offerings in verses 9 and 10. And then every month, you've got new moon or new month sacrifices. So the first set of sacrifices in these chapters are dealing with creation and the order of how the world works. But the second set are dealing with things that God has specifically done for the nation of Israel. You've got, for example, Passover, first fruits, and unleavened bread, which all take place over the course of 7 or 8 days. And so that's something that God did for the people. You've also got the Feast of Weeks. You've got the Feast of Trumpets. And then the most amount of time is spent on the Feast of Booths. So that's how this section is structured. Offerings associated with creation. And then you move into offerings associated with what God has specifically done for the nation. I'm going to have a couple charts up here in just a second that's going to help us understand some of these offerings and what they're doing. But let me highlight a couple things here. Look at chapter 28, verses 1 and 2, just to see how this section begins. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Command the people of Israel and say to them, 'My offering, my food for my food offerings, my pleasing aroma, you shall be careful to offer to me at its appointed time.'" So this section begins with God saying what about all these things? They're His. So here's instructions for you to know how to give something back to God that belongs to Him already. Now, does it matter when you do it? Yeah. Be careful to do it at my appointed times, at the times that He's telling them to do it. And so all throughout this chapter, one of the words that you're going to see is the word regular. You're going to see the word regular. I believe it was 17 times in these two chapters that he's going to talk about the regular offerings that they give. And then they have to do these other ones. But then there's the regular offerings that all throughout these chapters, he wants them to know that every single day, which is the regular daily offering, they're supposed to be giving something to God. And I think one of the lessons for us would be that God is expecting us, like what is it in Luke 9 somewhere where Jesus says to take up your cross daily? It's not just like a weekly or a monthly thing or a yearly thing. You're supposed to do it every day. And so I think he's training them in this way that the nation is supposed to make regular sacrifices every day. Another note of interest is throughout the chapter, there are seven extra Sabbaths that the nation is given throughout the year. On some of the feast days, Passover begins and ends with an extra Sabbath. Feast of Booths begins and ends with an extra Sabbath. Feast of Trumpets was also an extra Sabbath. So you've got seven extra Sabbaths throughout the year. But these feasts and these monthly things, what are they all looking forward to? Yeah, Teresa? Yeah, that's what, like Colossians 2:17 talks about all the new moon and the feasts and all these periods of time that God has ordained for worship, that all of these things are shadows of the true realities found in Christ. And so last year, right around the time that the Rona became a pandemic, it was actually on March 11th on Wednesday night was the last class, and we took that break. But when we studied the Jewish feast, you might remember this chart that we showed, that the feast of the Israelites, how many of you were in that class? I know some of you were. Okay. So you remember then one of the things that we noted is in the Old Testament, when God told the Israelites to come three times a year to Jerusalem to worship, well, there's seven feasts. So why come three times? Do you only have to go to three of seven of them? Or you see that they're bunched together. So in one trip, you get Passover, unleavened bread, and first fruits. You get all that in one trip. 50 days later at Pentecost, you have the one. And then towards the end of the year, you've got tabernacles, atonement, trumpets. I just said them in the wrong order. But you get those three in another trip. So in three trips, you get all seven feasts. And so God is telling them that when you guys have these worship assemblies, these times that have been designated by God to stir each other up to love and good works, Old Testament version, that you bring these extra sacrifices, that you dedicate things to God, that it's not about you, it's about what you're giving to God. All right, any comments or questions before I show? There's a couple more charts that I want to show here. All right. I'll leave this up for just a second. It's also in the printed out notes up here if you guys want to take that on your way out. But this chart shows you how the offerings were structured throughout the year and how these chapters lay out how many sacrifices they were supposed to do, how often, and everything like that. So you start with the first three being the ones in creation. Every single day, like a drum beat throughout the year, two lambs every day, two lambs every day. Does anybody know what time of the day they were supposed to do it at? Morning and evening. Twilight, around the time that Jesus was sacrificed. Maybe around the time Jesus at first got on the cross, and then around the time that he died. Could be the idea of that, I don't know. But then every Sabbath, they're supposed to add two more lambs. And then at the beginning of every month, they're supposed to do seven just for the beginning of the month, plus the regular one that they're due every day. So that's why these ones are in parentheses, that each of these days, the first number is the one that they're supposed to do on this particular day. And then you add two because every single day it's two plus whatever these other days would call for them to do. All right. And then you guys can look at this on your own time because the notes are printed out. But those are just the things that they're supposed to be constantly sacrificing to the Lord. Anything you guys want to say about that? All right. In addition to every animal that's offered, what did they have to give along with every animal? Grain and wine offerings. All right. So these chapters also deal with the same thing. And I showed a similar chart when we looked at Numbers 15. But one way you could think about these is that a lamb would be like a small meal size for God. A ram would be a medium meal size, and a bull would be like a large meal size. Because with each one of these, you have increasing supplements that have to be added to it. So with a lamb, 1/10 of an ephah, and here's the measurements, by the way. And then with the lamb, you also have a quarter hin of oil and then a quarter hin of wine. So it's not like if you're going to offer one lamb, it's just the lamb. You offer the lamb with the grain, oil mixed with grain, and then the wine. So it becomes like a whole meal, and depending on what you're having to offer, it's going to be more or it's going to be less. And so how much work would go into just one sacrifice? Quite a bit. Do you think you could have been an Israelite who just casually made sacrifices to God? What kind of mindsets and attitudes would have to exist if you were going to be a faithful Israelite in making a sacrifice? You're detail-oriented? What else? You're planning for it? What else? Okay, good. It's the first thing that you're going to take care of. What else? Yeah, you're going to have to budget. Can you imagine, like, you know, every year you've got the first fruits and everything, and you're what would be the lesson of having to constantly do things like this? God is training them to understand what? It all belongs to Him. Yeah. That's right. Yeah, and this brings us back to the question, how could they ever do this? They would have to be brought into a land, like God promised, that was going to be flowing with milk and honey. That's the only way they could do these things. Now, I think I did the math right, but this would be the total minimum yearly sacrifices. 1,044 lambs, 31 rams, 101 bulls. That's just the animals. Those are the minimum requirements, because this is what happens at the temple. This is what the priesthood would be doing. But then if you were an individual Israelite who wanted to bring your own sacrifice, then you add more to those numbers, and you've got a lot of Israelites. There's a lot of animals every year. But then along with the minimum animals, you have the minimum 2,000 pounds of flour at least, 1,000 bottles of oil and wine around that number. And so that's what's happening just at the temple. That's directed by God, not part of what the people are freely giving to the Lord for their thankfulness and whatever else. I thought I saw a couple of hands. Sewell, were you going to say something?
I'm just thinking that the prophet said that what God was really interested in was not the animals and but the dedication and the faithfulness with which they offered it.
That's right. Yeah, like Psalm 51 shows this, that it wasn't just about making the sacrifices by rote. God was concerned about cultivating a certain kind of heart that these things would help them learn how to have. Good. Anything else? Yeah. I mean, what a bummer. Like, if you didn't love God, like, how frustrating would this be? You know, yeah, good. Anything else?
So. Wouldn't some of those sacrifices for unintentional sin cover some of this if you fail to get the thing just right?
So the question being some of the unintentional sins. Like, look at the monthly offerings. This is the first time that we see a sin offering. Look at Numbers 28, starting in verse 11. At the beginning of your months, you shall offer a burnt offering to the Lord, two bulls from the herd, one ram, seven male lambs a year old without blemish, also 3/10 of an ephah of fine flour for a grain offering mixed with oil for each bull, and 2/10 of fine flour for a grain offering mixed with oil for one ram, and 1/10 of fine flour mixed with oil as a grain offering for every lamb for a burnt offering with a pleasing aroma, a food offering to the Lord. Their drink offering shall be 1/2 hin of wine for a bull, 1/3 hin of wine for a ram, 1/4 hin of hin for a lamb, and for a burnt offering of each month throughout the months of the year. Also one male goat for a sin offering to the Lord. It shall be offered besides the regular burnt offering and its drink offering. The first time that you have a sin offering, and I think we see this here with this goat, is at the beginning of months, of every month. Well, why a sin offering at the beginning of every month? I wonder if that would be for the unintentional sins. We know that the Day of Atonement does that, but it's like, it seems like they're beginning every month with that kind of idea as well for the unintentional sins, it seems. So, yeah, Susan? Yes. Yes, very good point. That one of the things that this is teaching you is that if you want to be in regular fellowship with God, it's going to require these sacrifices and these offerings, which Jesus is the one time for all time sacrifice. That without those sacrifices, you can't be in fellowship with God. Very good. Anything else? Yeah, Janice? That's right. Yep. Yeah, Nanette? Right. Yeah, good. Very good. All right, let's move on to this final chapter here that we're looking at today on vows. And we won't read all of this. I'll point out a couple things. Let's start out by, okay, so what he's going to do in this chapter is he's going to talk about vows that a man would make. He's going to talk about vows that a woman under her father's care or a daughter would make. A woman who's engaged, a woman who is widowed or divorced, a woman who's married. And so he's going to list out, this is what you do with vows. Now, this expands on Leviticus 27. So we're getting some new laws for them as they would be getting into the promised land. This is how you would handle some of the vows. Look at verses 1 and 2 just to get started. Moses spoke to the heads of the tribes of the people of Israel, saying, "This is what the Lord commanded. If a man vows a vow to the Lord or swears an oath to bind himself by a pledge, he shall not break his word. He shall do according to all that proceeds out of his mouth." All right, here's a question that I have about this. Why would you talk about vows after you've had two chapters dealing with offerings? Teresa? Aren't those things often accompanying one another? Like, look at one of the final verses of chapter 29. Look at chapter 29, verse 39. "These you shall offer to the Lord at your appointed feasts, in addition to your vow offerings and your freewill offerings, for your burnt offerings and for your grain offerings and for your drink offerings and for your peace offerings." And so he's just told them all these instructions that these are what you have to do. And then you also might be making your vow offerings. By the way, here's some instructions on vows. If a man makes a vow, what does he have to do? He's got to keep it. All right, so that's pretty plain and simple. You do what you say. Now, look at verses 3 through 5. "If a woman vows a vow to the Lord and binds herself by a pledge while within her father's house in her youth, and her father hears of her vow and her pledge by which she has bound herself and says nothing to her, then all her vows shall stand, and every pledge by which she has bound herself shall stand. But if her father opposes her on the day that he hears of it, no vow of hers, no pledge by which she has bound herself shall stand, and the Lord will forgive her because her father opposed her." All right. What is instructed for a woman under her father's care? What was that? Do what who says? Okay, do what your father says. What else? Autonomy? Yeah, she doesn't seem to have autonomy to make her own vow, right? Like, it needs to be green-lighted by whoever the father figure, or whoever the father would be. And then it's going to be the same kind of laws for a husband, that if a woman is married, it's got to be green-lighted by the husband. But it says that if the father doesn't oppose it, then she's got to keep it. So if he doesn't say anything, if he hears, oh yeah, my daughter said she's vowing to the Lord that if blah, blah, blah happens, then I'm going to do this, that, or the other thing, or I'm vowing to the Lord that for the rest of my life I'm going to do this, that, or the other thing, and he says nothing, then that's the green light for it to happen. But the father has to oppose it on what day? The same day that she makes it. All right. Is God being... Are we going back to the misogynistic, sexist God that we thought we forsook in Numbers 27? What was that? Right, so why wouldn't it go both ways, though? Why wouldn't the husband have protection from the wife to say, no, husband, don't do that? Yeah. Yeah, the responsibility of leadership does go on the husband. And so if the husband's not going to say anything, then you've got the woman who's engaged. I think it's a woman that's engaged in 6 through 8. Again, if the husband doesn't oppose it, she must keep the vow. If the husband opposes it on the day, she's not going to have to keep the vow. But look at verse 8. But if on the day that her husband comes to hear of it, he opposes her, then makes void her vow that was on her, and the thoughtless utterance of her lips by which she bound herself, and the Lord will forgive her. So what kind of utterance is he protecting her from? A thought. Have you ever thoughtlessly entered into agreement or thoughtlessly said, I'll do this, that, or the other thing, and then you didn't really think about it? Wouldn't it be nice to have somebody that could kind of like void or veto what you said? The women had that benefit and that blessing in the nation of Israel. Now, we'll talk in just a second why that might be the case. Look at verse 9. This is dealing with a widow or a divorced woman. In verse 9, but if any vow of a widow or of a divorced woman, anything by which she has bound herself shall stand against her. All right, so if you're a widow or a divorced person, what happens if you make a vow? There's nobody, you've got to keep it. There's no husband, there's no father figure that's going to look after that. So why would that be the case? What are we learning? Okay, imagine for a moment that you're a father of a daughter and she vows herself to do something. Or you're a husband and your wife vows herself to do something. Who is the provider for that person? The father or the husband? So what if a wife or a daughter says something that the husband goes, he looks at their checkbook, or he looks at what they're able to afford. He's like, look, I really appreciate your desire to want to do these things, but we can't afford that right now. That's not something that really is going to work for us right now. He's the one providing the sustenance that would make these vows even possible. And so I wonder if that's why the widow or the divorced person, you say something, there's nobody that you're costing anything. Like, you're making that vow by yourself and you've got to keep it. Any comments or questions about that? Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and verses 10 through 16, a woman who's married, it's just the same kind of thing that we've seen. But I think the overall point of this chapter, how concerned is God with us keeping our words? Do people make vows today? What vows might people make today? Yeah, wedding vows. And hasn't God been keeping his word to the Israelites in the book of Numbers who don't deserve it? like, and then towards the end of the book, he says, and you got to, by the way, imitate God. Whatever you say, you got to keep that. What, any other vows that people might make today? Yeah, sometimes people in moments of crisis will say, God, if you help me with this, then if I get through this, then I'll do X, Y, or Z for you, Teresa. Yeah, aren't you making a commitment? Like, you're signing up to follow him, no matter how bad things might get. You're making a commitment to die to yourself daily and serve him the rest of your life. Yes, Sewell?
Even commitment
to make payment on something and satisfy debt. Yeah. Good, paying off debts. Have you ever heard of Christians today saying, like, making some kind of a vow, like, the rest of my life I know I've heard stories or examples of people making some kind of commitment for the rest of their life that's not bound in Scripture, but it's something that they feel really committed to do. Sewell?
Isn't that what Jesus is saying when he said, let your yes be yes and your no, no?
Right. Right, you're going
to
keep your word without even having to swear, but whatever you say is going to be something that... Yeah, good. Any other thought? Have you guys ever known of anybody that said, like, I vow that I will, for the rest of my life, only do this, that, or the... What if a Christian did that today? Like, what? I'm just going to come up with a silly example, but what if a Christian today said, I vow for the rest of my life that I'm going to go paleo the rest of my life, diet-wise. Well, I don't even know what's in the paleo diet. But, like, what if you vowed to do that? Like, does God expect us to keep any vows that we make? I think so. What about Jephthah? Whatever comes out of my house, I'll offer as a burnt offering. Like, I guess animals just lived in his house or something. Yeah. Well, what if I make a promise that I'm going to become a drug dealer to somebody? Should I keep that vow? Yeah, you repent. If you make a bad vow, you don't keep your bad vow if it's a sinful vow. I think Jephthah maybe, I don't know, could have backtracked on that one. Yeah. A rash vow. In what verse? In verse 8? Okay. Yeah, that's like what Jephthah did. But Jephthah didn't have anybody that could override his vow, I guess. That's right. Yeah, if he gives me the victory... Right. I know a preacher friend of mine who he was working in a construction job before he ever became a preacher, but he always kind of thought he wanted to be a preacher, and he had to be like up on these giant stilt things that like he was doing some kind of electrical work or something, and he was really high up and the stilts were kind of moving, and he prayed to himself in that moment that if God would save him from this, that he would dedicate the rest of his life to preaching, and that's exactly what he's done. So, if you're going to make some kind of commitment to the Lord, beyond the obvious ones of marriage and when you're baptized into Christ, God, I think, expects us to keep the things that we said that we're going to do. Say, oh, yeah, yeah, okay, good. Like, maybe you're going through AA or something like that. Good. Good. All right. Well, those are... That's your new favorite section in the book of Numbers, chapters 27 to 30. Like I said, I think we'll do two more classes on the book of Numbers. And after that, I don't know yet if we'll take like a month break and then start something new, or if we'll just keep going every other week. But I'm still open to hearing suggestions. Somebody has said Romans. I was thinking about doing Leviticus. And so it's up to you guys, whatever you would like me to do. If I get more people, like I said in the email, if I get more people saying this, that, or the other thing, then that will sway my opinion. So thanks so much for your interest in this, and I'll see you guys, Lord willing, back at this study in 2 weeks.